We are talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I wanted to start out and give listeners and everyone a quick update on station news, as I had posted on social media and our website, which is having problems at the moment. The station, we're officially getting kicked out of the space we are in, our studio broadcast space here in the U District, as of January 1st. We're not the only ones being kicked out. Everyone's being kicked out because the building is being knocked down and renovated, make room for bigger and better things. So sometime between now and then, our over-the-air terrestrial broadcast will stop. I don't have a firm date set on that because it's multiple factors are involved, but so that's going to affect, obviously, the smaller group of you that listens over the air. But our plan is to continue streaming online, as we have been, 24/7, until and if we can find new digs that are affordable and less affordable in the greater Seattle area. So just wanted to let you know on that so you are not completely shocked when it happens. On that cheery news, let's move on to other cheery news. Local, with a sweep that finally happened yesterday at Cal Anderson Park.
Yeah, it was originally supposed to happen on Wednesday, and then a lawsuit was filed to try and stop it, with the eminently sensible concern that sweeping homeless people during a pandemic is a bad public health idea. Especially since there's nowhere for them to go particularly. The city has not done a very good job of placing people in housing. And that lawsuit failed on Thursday evening. So on bright and early on Friday morning, you had, King County Sheriff helicopters overhead. You had SWAT teams in place. It was a huge operation to sweep homeless people out of Cal Anderson Park and their supporters as well. And it went relatively quickly. There were some arrests, I believe about 20 all told. I haven't seen a final tally as of this morning. But, it's mind-boggling that, so much money was spent sweeping Cal Anderson Park between the helicopters and the SWAT teams and the police overtime and the legal fees and all the rest of it. You probably could have housed everybody who was camping in that park for a year. But that's not how the city of Seattle rolls. It's once again a scheme of whack-a-mole where we don't want them in one particular neighborhood. So we move them to another neighborhood, and then we push them out of that neighborhood to a different neighborhood. And, there are people probably camping in Cal Anderson again today, because there's really no place for them to go right now. And because, honestly, it's safer for people to camp outdoors than it is to stay in indoor shelters right now, given the pandemic. I do not understand why HSD and Mayor Durkin and the Parks Department insist on this strategy, which the city has been pursuing for some 25 years, and it clearly is not working.
Well, I think the case in Cal Anderson Park is that they had a lot of local businesses on in the Broadway and Pike Pine area that were asking the city government to do something about those icky homeless people and reopen Cal Anderson Park. Never mind that there are other parks nearby where homeless people are still camping, like up at the Miller Community Center, for example.
Yeah, and Volunteer Park too.
Mm-hmm.
This is how the city rolls. That we've seen this downtown also when businesses or neighborhood groups get upset about the presence of homeless people, they get swept out. It's penny wise and pound foolish, in my opinion, because, there's no overarching strategy for how to deal with these folks other than we just don't want them there. you know, we've seen this in the International District in Little Saigon. Pretty much all of the close to downtown neighborhoods where homeless people tend to congregate because that's where the services are. So this will be an ongoing problem, I'm sure.
All right, moving on. The CPC. Apparently, yeah. Had some questions about SPD's proposed changes, which is news to a lot of people that they're proposing some changes.
The Community Police Commission this week reviewed the Seattle Police Department's proposed changes to their crowd control policy, and they had questions. Now, the SPD gave these proposed changes to the CPC, the Office of Police Accountability, and the Office of the Inspector General for the Seattle Police Department a couple weeks ago. And as usual with the SPD, they then asked these three groups to keep the proposed changes secret from the public. Now, the Community Police Commission is meant to be the body that both represents the public in overseeing the police department and the body that takes public input on policy changes at SPD, right? So naturally, they pretty quickly reviewed the proposed changes and issued a list of 10 questions for the Seattle Police Department. The first four of those questions were what I would call their core questions about the draft crowd control policy, and number one is the most important, and I'm just going to quote from that. The quote is, what is SPD's plan to hear from the community at large about their thoughts on these changes, end quote, because the SPD had asked the CPC to keep the policy changes secret, right? The other three of their first four involve kind of the broad questions about the policy. Number two was SPD, instead of getting rid of some of the less lethal weapons as the CPC had recommended, is actually adding some new ones. And the Community Police Commission wants to know why they're doing that and how they think that's being responsive to the community. The third item on their list, the draft policies don't incorporate most of the Community Police Commission's recommendations and will giving feedback on this draft make any difference? So will SPD really care what the Community Police Commission says since they're not being responsive with this new draft? And then the fourth question, the draft policies make only minor wording changes and they don't change the use of force core principles. Is that the SPD's official position? That's what the CPC is asking. And the remaining six items on their list ask questions about specifics within the draft policy, except for the final one, number 10, which I think is another key question and worth quoting in full. So their 10th question is, quote, the policy changes also say that the Seattle Police Department is committed to upholding laws while protecting all human life and property and maintaining civil order. After what we've seen over the past years, it's still the SPD's position that police should protect property and order as much as they protect human life. Right. So number 10 really gets at the core reason why the SPD is being asked to make these changes to its crowd control policies, because their current policies and actions, I would argue, prioritize the protection of property over and above the protection of human life, given the danger that these that their current policies have brought to peaceful protesters and to bystanders.
And it was interesting at the sweep of Cal Anderson yesterday, one of the chants of the protesters, the people who were trying to protect the encampment, was, we protect people, you protect property. So yeah. that has not escaped the attention of the protesters.
No, absolutely. Now, initially, a representative from the Seattle Police Department was going to meet with the CPC this week during their Thursday meeting to discuss the changes to their use of force crowd control policy. But that person canceled after the CPC sent these 10 questions to her. Essentially, she said that she had expected the CPC to only have minor changes to the, quote, the form of the policy, not the substance. So, you know, you have to kind of scratch your head and ask, what the heck does she mean? I guess she was expecting the CPC to proofread the policy and maybe suggest some grammatical changes or a renumbering of the sections. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, the punctuation is important in these things.
Right. And so the SPD didn't respond to the CPC about their plan for public input. Instead, when confronted with the reality that their draft policy was going to be leaked to the local press, the SPD this week posted the draft policy on their website, along with a pop-up questionnaire for the public that has only three questions. The first question is, what do you like about this policy? And you're required to put something. You're required to put an answer in that box because it won't take you to the next question if you don't, right? So you have to say something that you like about the policy. And then the second question pops up and says, what don't you like about the policy? And again, you have to put in something to get the third question. And the third question is, this policy should be implemented as is with a slider bar that gives you two choices, either agree or disagree. That's their request for public input.
That's a robust
Oh, yeah.
Query.
Yeah. So on Thursday, when the CPC met and they realized they weren't going to get a representative from SPD to answer their questions, they discussed the possibility of holding a public forum to discuss the policies publicly and take input from the public on the draft changes. If the SPD is not interested in being part of that forum, the CPC discussed asking the city council to join them and discuss the policies with them. And that may be on the horizon here within the next couple of weeks. So if you want to go and read the policies and make comments, you can go to the SPD blotter at spdblotter.seattle.gov, G-O-V. And it's their post-dated December 16th, entitled SPD Seeks Community Feedback on Draft Use of Force Crowd Management Policies, end quote. And you can fill out that little three-question questionnaire. But it's also a really good place to just kind of read through and see what changes they're making. And it's very instructive because the first one, which is their sort of overall use of force policy section, you pop it open and you see the changes are extremely minor. You know, just a few words here and there, changing some words from may to will. You know, I mean, the changes are so small. Mm. Yeah. And there, you could argue that it changes the intent or strengthens the policy, but my feeling is it's just kind of cosmetic.
Yeah, Kevin Schofield at SEC Insight did a good write-up on it as well. If people want to check out his site.
And he also has links to all that stuff.
Yeah. I saw one of the many items that he highlighted on their list of changes that jumped out at me was 40-millimeter less lethal launchers may be used by any trained officer and are no longer reserved just for SWAT officers.
Yeah.
So just to give you a sense expanding the use of weapons there.
Yeah, and expanding the types of weapons too. So it doesn't in any way respond to Judge Jones's order that the Seattle Police Department refrain from using, these weapons in order to manage a crowd. In fact, it pretty much spits in the face of that court order.
Okay. City Council was still doing things this week, although I think this is last week prior to the holiday, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yes.
I don't imagine them getting a whole lot more done after Christmas. But this week, the City Council passed the new ordinance requiring lobby groups to register with the city. The full council, it was passed by the council governance committee the week before this past week. And then this week, the full council passed the legislation to require AstroTurf lobbying groups to register with the city of Seattle and provide the sources of their funding. Groups that would have to register are defined as any organization that spends at least $750 per month trying to influence the public to lobby local politicians to pass or defeat legislation. Shama Sawant predictably raised an objection to the bill, saying that it shouldn't apply to grassroots groups communicating grassroots group communicating with its own membership the way Socialist Alternative does. Lorena Gonzalez then proposed an amendment to say that it wouldn't cover groups communicating with their own membership, and the law then passed by a vote of 8-1, with Sawant voting no. She was not persuaded that the amendment would be strong enough to allow true grassroots organizations to organize without interference from the city. It might be difficult, for example, for a group to prove with the city auditor that it's just communicating with its own membership unless that group also provided a membership list to the city auditor. And that raises all kinds of issues with left-wing and progressive groups who have historically had tussles with both local and federal governments that have tried to get copies of membership lists in order to prosecute or persecute members of these groups, particularly communist and socialist groups. It's a fine line between requiring paid lobbyists to register and disclose their funding sources versus going after the same information from small political parties and true grassroots groups. So I'm just thinking there could be a lawsuit or two on the horizon over this law. We'll just see. And it's a law that could be abused if you had a very conservative council and conservative mayor who tries to go after a group like Socialist Alternative.
Moving on, this perhaps might be our only piece of good news for the week. Sound Transit. Yeah.
Well, it's a little bit of good news for the year 2021, and only for this coming year. The Sound Transit Board voted this week on a new sort of temporary fare enforcement policy. In 2021, the agency will stop contracting with Securitas to provide fare enforcement officers on Sound Transit light rail and buses and on the Sounder trains. Instead, Sound Transit will employ what they're going to be calling fare engagement ambassadors.
and wow.
Yes, that is pretty laughable. Those ambassadors will check whether passengers have paid a fare, and if they catch you not paying your fare, they will. They're supposed to try to educate you on how to do it properly, the need to do it, and they will issue you a warning, but no citations or fines, and courts will not get involved, at least in 2021.
I know how to pay the fare. I just can't afford it.
Yeah, exactly. This comes after a study of fare enforcement from 2015 to 2019, showing that Black riders were disproportionately targeted for citations and fines when riding Sound Transit light rail and commuter trains. Metro Transit, in contrast, has done away with fare enforcement completely on Metro buses after a study showed that fare enforcement unfairly targets and burdens homeless people and the poor. And of course, keep in mind this new policy is just in effect for 2021. The Sound Transit Board is expected to reevaluate and vote again next year on whether to extend it or reimpose fare enforcement, including fines of up to $124 for people who don't pay or can't pay a $3 fare. And of course, that can be followed by a court judgment and additional costs if they don't pay or can't pay the $124 fine. So,
you know, given the disproportionate enforcement on communities of color, it sounds to me like it's the enforcement people who need education and not the riders.
Yeah, and I would say the Sound Transit Board as well. Remember that Dow Constantine and Jenny Durkin both sit on the Sound Transit Board. Jenny Durkin has kind of waffled back and forth between supporting and then not supporting fare enforcement. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, there are other members of transit agencies in the region who also sit on the Sound Transit Board. I think the Sound Transit Board is a mix of people who might be sympathetic to poor folks who have trouble paying the fares and people who feel like there has to be some consequences for fare jumpers. But remember, too, that Sound Transit collects a lot of money in fare enforcement fines. Something like $97 million a year. And that's about 30% of their operating revenue. So,
wow.
You know, yeah. Those fines are an important revenue source for them. And in fact, Sound Transit board members have pointed to that before, saying, can we afford to give that up? You know, but remember who's being charged these fines too. And that's just, I would argue, probably the most regressive tax imaginable.
All right. Moving on. Governor Inslee made multiple announcements this week.
Yes. Yeah, speaking of somebody who's not going to D.C.
Well, that we know of. Yeah.
Yeah. So we had a Friday evening news dump last night that Jay Inslee has issued an executive order delaying implementation of the new law banning single-use plastic bags in Washington state that was passed by the legislature this past year and due to take effect on January 1st. And Inslee cited supply chain problems caused by the pandemic, people using more bags, using more delivery bags, and stores not wanting people to bring their own bags because of public health concerns. So that has been delayed until January 31st. So it's only a month, but that is being delayed. And he also came out Friday morning with the only explanation that I've actually seen as to why Pfizer's vaccine, the second tranche of deliveries to various states for next week has been cut by 30 to 40% across apparently almost all states, and apparently that was the reason for that was that there was a miscalculation somewhere in the process between Pfizer and the federal government of the federal government based its delivery calculations on the number of doses of vaccine that had been manufactured. But apparently some of those doses hadn't gone through quality control after the manufacturing process yet. And so those doses are in the pipeline. They're just not going to be available next week. And it really underscores.
Although Pfizer was saying they had doses sitting packed and ready to go in their warehouse. And that wasn't the real issue. My guess is because the Pfizer vaccine is being shipped out by third-party delivery services like private delivery services like FedEx and UPS, that and because of the holiday package ordering is so much higher this year that there may be delays with delivery.
Yeah, you had the White House blaming Pfizer and Pfizer blaming the White House. And honestly, this may be the first time in like my life that I think Big Pharma has more credibility than the federal government.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting that that Donald Trump isn't asking the military to get involved in shipping what you could argue is a true emergency medicine out to the different distribution centers in each state. And they're relying on private delivery service to do that.
Yeah, they want to privatize everything.
Yeah, I find that astounding.
And it's not just the vaccines. We're running into shortages of N95 masks and gowns and gloves and other personal protective equipment for frontline health workers. And this is coming after 9 months of the pandemic. There is absolutely no excuse for that. That is a failure of the federal government. Full stop.
Yeah. So back to Governor Inslee.
Sure.
I'm not quite ready to go to national news yet. This week, Governor Inslee announced his draft budget for Washington State. The budget will be for the next two-year budget cycle. So unlike here in the city of Seattle, where the city council agreed with Jenny Durkin to just do a one-year budget for 2021, our governor has actually drafted a budget for 2021 and 2022. The big news in his draft budget is that it includes a capital gains tax, like it did last year. His capital gains tax this time around is a 9% capital gains tax on earnings, capital gains earnings above $25,000 for individuals or $50,000 for couples. Now, the income that's exempt from this tax includes any wages or salary income, business income from a Schedule C or other sole proprietorship, proceeds from the sale of your primary residence or home, capital gains from any retirement accounts like a 401k or an IRA, proceeds from the sale of farms or forest land. So anything, and as folks may not know, capital gains are usually what you've earned when you sell an asset, any amount that you collect over and above what you paid for that asset. So mostly just income from the sale of things like stocks and bonds in non-retirement accounts, vacation homes, and other investment properties. And then only profits above $25,000 for singles and $50,000 for couples. Now, if the legislature passes this, the state could begin collecting the revenue in 2022. It would not go into effect next year because of COVID-19. Now, Inslee also proposed a second way to raise revenue, a tax on health insurers, health service contractors, and Medicaid managed care organizations through a monthly per member fee on these companies, not on their customers. The insurance commissioner's office would manage and oversee the tax. So that's his two main revenue raisers. On the expense side, Inslee's budget proposes $397 million to pay for COVID-19 testing, supplies, PPE, lab costs, and vaccine distribution throughout the state, as well as to help with the Washington State Health Care Plan. $328 million would be used for rental assistance for the state's renters who could face eviction when rent moratoriums end. $400 million would go for education funding to help schools and families adjust to remote learning and bridge any gaps in that system. And I would argue that $400 million is probably not enough for that. There was also additional funding to continue remaking Washington's mental health care system to try to fix and patch up a very broken system. And there's also money for capital projects, including fixing road culverts to allow fish passage or as mandated by the Supreme Court, as well as other infrastructure around the state. So those are kind of the general outlines of his budget. And because of the COVID-19 lockdown, the state budget shortfall had, at the beginning of his attempts to balance the budget, had a shortfall of $2.4 billion. And that's actually the good news compared to what the estimated shortfall was as of an earlier revenue forecast in June, which estimated an $8.8 billion shortfall. So when you look at that, $2.4 billion is looking pretty good. But
one of the things that I thought was interesting was that Inslee did not assume that there was going to be any relief for state governments from Congress.
Mm-hmm. I think he's going to be right about that.
I think so as well, because the Republicans are dead set against it. And we'll talk about those negotiations in a little bit. But, I think he did a really good job of finding ways to have relatively non-regressive revenue given the constraints of the state constitution and with missing what ought to be support from the federal government.
Yeah, and I should say, too, that like in prior years, Governor Inslee's budget is just a proposal and not even particularly the starting point for the state legislature, where the Democrats have routinely ignored his proposals in the past and come up with their own draft budgets that usually look very different. For example, Inslee has proposed tax increases before, as well as a cap and trade system for greenhouse gas emissions, and the state legislature has completely ignored his proposals in the past. Although this year, apparently, he has had input and help with from State Senator Reuven Carlisle in crafting another cap and trade plan that may actually become legislation this year in the state legislature. So we'll just see if that bill gets introduced and what the parameters are.
Yeah, that would be very good news.
That would be very good news. And there's also been discussion of by the Democratic Party in the legislature of drafting and potentially passing a capital gains tax. So, this may be the year when the Democrats take up much more of Governor Inslee's draft budget than they have in past years.
All right. Is that a fingers crossed type?
That's a fingers crossed, yeah.
Okay.
It'll be an interesting legislative session, particularly since much of it is going to have to be done remotely this coming January, starting this coming January.
All right. Well, let's move on to this week's COVID updates.
Oh, yeah. It's not looking good. People may have picked up on that by now. Washington State is now looking well. And the part of Washington State that's worst right now is the Puget Sound area. It's King County, Pierce County, Snohomish County. So, keep social distancing, keep wearing masks in public, keep washing your hands, do all of those things. The area did receive the first shipment of Pfizer vaccines. The first ones were given on Tuesday at the University of Washington Medical Center, and it's been since delivered to other hospital systems around the metropolitan area. So that's the good news. The bad news is that it's probably going to take several months for those vaccines to be available to the general public. And we saw Moderna's vaccine approved by the FDA last night as well. So that will be arriving in Washington State next week as well. So there is hope on the horizon, but it's going to take time. First you have frontline medical workers receiving the vaccine, and then people who work in long-term care facilities, and then people who are immunocompromised or otherwise have pre-existing conditions or over age 65, and then it will be available to the general public. That's probably going to take until late spring at best for the general public to be able to receive the vaccine. So we'll see whether these initial vaccinations can help flatten the curve in Washington State. Right now, the case numbers are still going up. It's not looking good. So just continue to be careful and celebrate your holidays remotely. That's where we are.
We talked last week a little bit about what a vaccine can and can't do. That getting vaccinated means that you would be less likely to get the very severe form of COVID-19, but not necessarily that it wouldn't necessarily protect you from getting sick and being able to spread the virus.
And most importantly, it doesn't necessarily protect you from being asymptomatic and still spreading. The whole idea of vaccinations is to try and prevent community spread.
Yeah.
And right now, community spread is rampant everywhere in the country.
And to do that, a certain percentage of the population needs to be vaccinated. Public health officials have said over 70%. I think when we look at other viruses that are airborne and easy and spread easily, like COVID-19, viruses like whooping cough, for example, or the flu, you're really hoping to get closer to 90% of the population vaccinated in order to really end community spread. And that's going to take a long time, given that the vaccines, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, require two shots. And then of course there's the allergic reaction issue that was in the news again this week, because in Alaska, three people in the first 3 days that the vaccine was given had experienced allergic reactions that required hospitalization for at least two of them. A man with a history of allergies had a non-anaphylactic reaction, and he was treated successfully with a single dose of epinephrine and given Benadryl, which is an H1 blocker, and Famotidine, which is an H2 blocker, and both are old-style antihistamines that are very good treatments for mild allergic reactions, and he recovered very quickly within about an hour. But the other two cases were much more concerning. The second person was a woman with no history of allergies at all. She had an anaphylactic reaction within 10 minutes of receiving the vaccination, which included shortness of breath and elevated heart rate and a rash on her face and chest. She was treated with a dose of epinephrine and felt better and sent to the hospital, where she was administered a second dose of epinephrine and steroids when the first dose wore off and her anaphylactic reaction came back. And then she was put on a drip and to slowly wean her off over the course of a couple of days, because every time the epinephrine would start to wear off, the reaction would come back. Now, that's particularly concerning because she didn't have a history of allergic reactions of any kind, and a single dose of epinephrine didn't take care of the problem. She had a much more serious reaction. And then the third person, very similar to the second, had no previous allergic reactions, except she reported having a very minor reaction to a bee sting years ago. About 10 minutes after receiving the vaccine, her tongue had swelled and she had difficulty breathing, and that's a classic anaphylactic reaction. She was sent to the hospital, where she received two doses of epinephrine and was released 6 hours later. It took her a few hours to get over that. So the CDC then reported on Friday that they're investigating a total of 5 allergic reactions to the vaccine, including 2 additional new cases reported in Britain. So that changes the risk calculation a little bit for those of us who are not frontline workers or in assisted living facilities. Instead of rushing out to get the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine or the Moderna vaccine, which what I'm hearing is that it reportedly has more side effects than the Pfizer vaccine, we should maybe wait a little while to see if researchers and doctors can figure out what's causing these anaphylactic reactions. Now, you know, it could be the packaging, which would be an easy thing to change. It could be a preservative, or it could be a contaminant in the vaccine or in the dilutant, which is a saline solution that's injected into the vaccine vials when it's being readied to administer the vaccine. One chemical of concern that is an ingredient in both the vaccines by Pfizer and Moderna is polyethylene glycol. Could be a culprit behind these reactions. It's PEG is used to stabilize the fat coating around the virus spike protein to keep it from degrading. But PEG allergies do occur, but they are very, very rare, and it's usually considered an inert ingredient. I think another more important possibility is the issue we talked about earlier with the fact that Pfizer is using private delivery services like FedEx and UPS to deliver the vaccine to various locations around the country. And I think the reason I think that may be the issue is because the Pfizer vaccine has to be kept at extremely cold temperatures, much colder than is typical for cold shipments by private delivery services. And these cases are arising in far-flung places, not in mainland United States, where it's fairly easy to ship things, but up in Alaska is where all the cases have arisen here in the United States, and then in Britain, which is across the English Channel from where the vaccine's being manufactured in Belgium, in Europe. So I think there may be some major issues with the fact that the Pfizer vaccine has to be stored at such extremely cold temperatures, and it may be degrading and producing chemical compounds that cause these allergic reactions during the shipment process.
Yeah, the good news is that by the time this is available to the general public, we're going to have a much, much more complete record of where these allergic reactions are coming from and potentially fixes
for
them.
We hope we know.
Yeah.
In any case, we're
1 week in, and we're going to have several months worth of data by the time it's available to the general public.
Yeah. In any case, we're all going to have to wait anyway, since there aren't enough doses right now to even vaccinate all the medical personnel in every state, much less other frontline workers like EMTs, fire department personnel, police, et cetera. The Trump administration's vaccine distribution system appears to be struggling to get the promised doses out to the states on time. And I haven't heard the news yet on whether Moderna will be using private delivery service companies or if, because they took money from the federal government's Warp Speed vaccine development program, whether they will actually be able to mobilize government planes and perhaps the military to transport the Moderna vaccine, or if the Trump administration or the Biden administration will force them to also use private delivery services.
I believe at least initially they'll also be using private delivery services.
Yeah. Yeah. So given the fact that private delivery services as well as the U.S. Post Office are swamped, not just because of the holiday, but because of everybody living and working at home and requiring more supplies, more, you know, of the daily necessities delivered, that could be an issue.
And the cuts to the post office.
Yeah, that could be an issue.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, other updates on COVID-related news in nationally, California is in serious crisis. All of Southern California and the San Joaquin Valley is completely out of ICU beds available statewide. Only 2.1% of ICU beds are available in California. We had a court ruling in San Diego County on Thursday that two strip clubs had sued to stay open, protesting the state's pandemic closure requirements, and a superior court judge sided with them. That was overturned late last night in an appeals court because the original superior court judgment had not just allowed the strip clubs to stay open, but any establishments that serve food, which is to say any bars or restaurants in the state's second most populous county. That was immediately appealed, and it was overturned. No word yet on whether the overturning of that court ruling is in turn going to be appealed. So we had that. Congress is still negotiating a relief bill. They passed a 48-hour extension for their 2021 budget to avoid government shutdown late last night. So hopefully sometime over the weekend, they will come to agreement on a budget, and that will include some sort of a relief bill. The Republicans have thrown a last-minute demand into the negotiations that they want the Federal Reserve to not be able to stimulate the economy under the Biden administration. This is flat out the Republicans attempting to cripple the Biden administration as it attempts to deal with a serious recession.
They're trying to prevent the Federal Reserve from restarting business loan programs and programs that would buy up bonds and other securities to try to stimulate the economy. Programs that the Republicans have used just over the past year to try to keep the economy from tanking because of the COVID-19 lockdown. And I find that absolutely ridiculous, and I don't see how they could pass a law that would actually do that.
Yeah, the whole point of the Federal Reserve is that it is supposed to be independent of this kind of politicization. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's part of the Republican effort basically to to burn everything to the ground on the way out the door. They're trying to make it as difficult as possible for an incoming Biden administration to try and deal with, the pandemic, with the recession that's been caused by it. Unemployment numbers were back up again this past week. They're now pushing 900,000 a week, which we haven't seen since this summer. So the economy is not looking to be in good shape. You know, a lot of businesses are relying on some sort of relief measure from Congress that is almost certainly going to be inadequate because, you know, retail businesses rely on the Christmas season, and that's simply not happening this year. Certainly not for in-store retail. Amazon's doing quite well, thank you very much, but a lot of small businesses are really looking at not being able to survive, and there has been no help forthcoming from the federal government. The national federal eviction moratorium is scheduled to expire at the end of the year, as are unemployment extensions, and that double whammy is going to create a lot of people who suddenly don't have a place to live. And we'll see what Congress can come up with, if anything. But if they do, it's going to be in the next 24 to 48 hours.
All right. Let's move on. We got 10 minutes left. Talk about Biden's cabinet appointees this week.
Yeah. He put together the remaining members of his environmental team. This week, he announced Gina McCarthy as his senior advisor on climate change. McCarthy was the administrator of the EPA under Obama from 2013 to 2017. She was a former president and CEO of the National Resources Defense Council. She served as an environmental advisor to five Massachusetts governors, including Mitt Romney. Under Obama, she oversaw his biggest environmental programs like the Clean Power Plan, increases in fuel efficiency standards for automobiles, and limits to mercury and methane emissions, mercury emissions by power plants and methane emissions by the oil and gas industry. She'll be Biden's domestic climate czar, coordinating environmental policy across all the domestic departments of the U.S. government, while John Kerry will be the international climate czar, dealing with the international community and the State Department and perhaps also the Pentagon and its programs. Now, overall, I think she's an okay choice for this position, not the most progressive candidate, but someone who has a lot of administrative experience, and she understands how these agencies run, how they work, and how policy changes are made. And I think she's a strong person to help Biden carry out the policies that he wants and to coordinate them across the various departments. I think a better pick this week was Deb Haaland for Secretary of the Interior.
That's my favorite pick so far.
Much more progressive. Yeah. She's a U.S. House rep from New Mexico, former chair of the Democratic Party of New Mexico, really key in reviving the Democratic Party in the state of New Mexico. She's also a member of the Laguna Pueblo Native American tribe. She will be the first Native American to run the Department of the Interior, which oversees the nation's public lands, but is also oversees the nation's relationship with tribes and tribal lands. So that's
and that relationship has been broken for many, many years.
Many years.
You can see it in the federal response to the pandemic on reservations, which has just been terrible. The Indian Health Service is really dysfunctional. If nothing else, that's just hugely positive news for Native Americans, not just for the symbolism of being the first Native American cabinet member, but for...
Well, she's not the first Native American cabinet member, but she's the first one to run the Interior Department, which I think is really key.
It is.
Yeah.
And somebody who has firsthand experience with the federal government's relationship with reservations and Bureau of Indian Affairs. And then, beyond that, Native American tribes have been key in a number of environmental struggles around the country, and she has experience with and empathy for those struggles as well.
Yeah. Now, I think really importantly, Holland is what we would consider a real progressive, not just a progressive in name. She supports things like abolishing ICE and passing immigration reform. She supports the Green New Deal, and she's spoken in favor of Medicare for all. In her time as a U.S. representative, she served as the vice chair of the House Committee on Natural Resources, so she has some prior experience with the issues that the Interior Department would oversee. And she has served on the Committee on Oversight and Reform in the House. She's also co-chair of the Congressional Native American Caucus and is a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. She has the support of both the progressive wing and the centrist wing of the Democratic Party for this position as the Secretary of Interior. So that was probably the best news this week.
Yep, absolutely.
Now, in his other cabinet picks, Biden named Pete Buttigieg as Secretary of Transportation. Mayor Pete, who ran for president against Biden, has turned out to be one of his biggest supporters. For Biden's biggest supporters. Buttigieg is very young for this. At 38, he is one of the youngest people to ever hold a cabinet position. And his only political experience is a mayor of South Bend, Indiana, a city of about 100,000 people, which is about the same size as Everett, Washington.
I would flag that and say that running a major presidential campaign is in itself political experience. And he did remarkably well, given his lack of national profile going in. So I got to give him credit for that.
That's true. Now, he's known as for his skills as a communicator, somebody who has a very polished speaking style and is very likable in front of the camera. He'll be expected to promote electric vehicles and more funding for transit while he's overseeing the Department of Transportation. But the Transportation Department has a lot more than that, including overseeing some of the nation's most important and most decaying infrastructure. In addition to highways and bridges, it oversees railways and pipeline infrastructure. And then there's the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, which is helping to get Boeing 737 MAX back on its feet while ostensibly playing a firm oversight role, which critics have argued that the FAA has not been doing with the airline industry and airline manufacturers like Boeing. Now, I'm not as confident in Mayor Pete's ability to run this large organization at the federal level as Jav is, or necessarily in his commitment to pushing for cuts in greenhouse gas emissions in transportation, which is one of the biggest and most important sources for greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. I really hope that Pete Buttigieg surprises me as transportation secretary.
I'm also ambivalent about that choice. His history is being very cozy with corporate America, so that I don't have a lot of confidence in his ability to hold companies like Boeing accountable for their manufacturing snafus. And then, you know, the airline industry is going to need a lot of financial support to recover from the pandemic. And I expect that he will be a strong voice advocating for that.
Yeah. And of course, you know, there are issues of how is the airline industry going to address their greenhouse gas emissions? That's one of the trickiest sectors to deal with. It's going to be trying to figure out how the maritime industry and how the airline industry deal with global warming. And I'm not sure Pete Buttigieg has the background or the technical skills to figure that out or to put in place policies to deal with that.
Yeah.
So then let's move on to the last two. Jennifer Granholm was Biden's pick for Secretary of Energy. She's the former governor and former attorney general of the state of Michigan and the first woman to hold those two positions. She's an adjunct professor of law and public policy at UC Berkeley and a research fellow at the Berkeley Energy and Climate Institute, where she runs a campaign for a national clean energy policy. Granholm is a huge supporter of wind, solar, and advancements in battery storage for those two energy sources. As Secretary of Energy, she'll be overseeing the nation's aging nuclear stockpile and 17 national laboratories. The Department of Energy also oversees research and development into new energy sources, including green energy technology. And it also runs a large loan office for new businesses to launch new energy technologies into the private sphere. For example, the Department of Energy gave a big loan for the establishment of Tesla. So that's an example of some of the things she'll be overseeing. Now, Granholm, I think, is practically perfect for this job. I think she's a fine pick for energy secretary. She's not super progressive, but her experience in running large organizations and her background on energy technology, I think, is a real plus for this position. I thought that was a very good pick. Now, the final of Biden's cabinet picks is Michael Regan for administrator of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Progressives and environmentalists rejected Biden's first pick for this position, Mary Nichols, the California Clean Air Regulator. She had overseen California's cap and trade program, which many folks contend was set up to allow California businesses to just pay a little extra to keep polluting poor neighborhoods and places where people of color live. Progressives have been pushing for Biden to address environmental racism. And Biden chose Michael Regan, the secretary of North Carolina's Department of Environmental Quality. Regan will be the first black man to run the EPA. He started out working in the EPA during the Clinton administration, then worked at the Environmental Defense Fund before taking a job as the top environmental regulator for the state of North Carolina in 2017. Regan has worked to get Duke Energy to clean up toxic coal ash in the state, and he led in fighting the Trump administration's efforts to drill for oil off the coast of North Carolina. He has also worked with environmentalists to remove perfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAs, from the state's drinking water. He also helped negotiate a deal to reduce North Carolina's power plant emissions by 70% by the year 2030. But there isn't a lot of evidence that he's actually worked for racial equity in his office. He also has a spotty record in policing pollution from corporate hog farms and the wood pellet industry, which are two major industries in his state. Regan's going to have a lot of work ahead of him in reversing the Trump administration's efforts to literally gut the EPA, to overturn dozens of regulations and to end the enforcement of hundreds of others. He's going to have to rebuild an agency that's seen a massive exodus of its best staff, including leading scientists and researchers. And once the U.S. rejoins the climate Paris Agreement, he's going to play a leading role in carrying out new policies to cut greenhouse gas emissions nationwide, with potentially a hostile Senate not wanting to pass bills that would do that. So I think he's a good pick, not the most progressive, but a strong pick with a lot of background in environmental regulation. But he also has the hardest job ahead of him of any of these cabinet picks so far, I think.
Yeah. And I want to underscore very briefly one of the things you mentioned in passing, which was his taking on Duke Energy, which basically has been running the state of North Carolina for a long time. That was a major lift politically, and he did a good job of that.
That's actually I think actually argues for him as being a strong pick for the EPA. Now, there are still some positions left to fill in the cabinet. The big one is attorney general, Biden also has his business labor team to pull together for the secretaries of commerce, labor, education, and the small business information, Small Business Administrator, excuse me. And then there's the CIA director. And I'm hoping that after watching the terrible performance of the current CIA director, Gina Haspel, who's been a major Trump enabler, that Biden picks someone from outside of the agency to run it. I hope he doesn't do what he did with the Department of Defense, where he picked a former general to fill what should be a civilian role. I hope he picks someone who can exercise proper oversight over the CIA. So we'll see.
Okay, with that, we are out of time.